Chapter 26. "Oh, Mrs. Quentin," she broke out, "I didn't mean to tell you this. I never dreamed of it till this moment, but you do remember what you said, don't you? You must remember it. And now that I've met you in this way, I can't help telling you that I believe I begin to believe that you were right after all." Mrs. Quentin had listened without moving, but now she raised her eyes with a slight smile. "Dee, do you wish me to say this to Alan?" she asked. The girl flushed, but her glance braved the smile. "Would he still care to hear it?" she said fearlessly. Mrs. Quentin took momentary refuge in a renewed inspection of the Boltraffio. Then, turning, she said, with a kind of reluctance, "He would still care." "Ah!" broke from the girl. During this exchange of words, the two speakers had drifted unconsciously toward one of the benches. Mrs. Quentin glanced about her. A custodian who had been hovering in the doorway sauntered into the adjoining gallery, and they remained alone among the silvery vandyks and flushed bituminous halses. Mrs. Quentin sank down on the bench and reached a hand to the girl. "Sit by me," she said. Miss Fenno dropped beside her. In both women, the stress of emotion was too strong for speech. The girl was still trembling, and Mrs. Quentin was the first to regain her composure. "You say you've suffered," she began at last. "Dee, do you suppose I haven't? I knew you had. That made it so much worse for me that I should have been the cause of your suffering for Alan." Mrs. Quentin drew a deep breath. "And not for Alan only," she said. Miss Fenno turned on her a wondering glance. "And not for Alan only. That pain every woman expects and knows how to bear. We all know our children must have such disappointments, and to suffer with them is not the deepest pain. It's the suffering apart in ways they don't understand." She breathed deeply. "I want you to know what I mean. You were right that day, and I was wrong." "Oh," the girl faltered. Mrs. Quentin went on in a voice of passionate lucidity. I knew it then, I knew it, even while I was trying to argue with you, I've always known it. I didn't want my son to marry you till I heard your reasons for refusing him, and then I longed to see you his wife. Oh, Mrs. Quentin. I longed for it, but I knew it mustn't be." "Mustn't be?" Mrs. Quentin shook her head sadly, and the girl, gaining courage from this mute negation, cried with an uncontrollable escape of feeling. "It's because you thought me hard, obstinate, narrow-minded? Oh, I understand that so well. My self-righteousness must have seemed so petty. A girl who could sacrifice a man's future to her own moral vanity, for it was a form of vanity. You showed me that plainly enough, how you must have despised me. But I am not that girl now, indeed I'm not. I'm not impulsive, I think things out. I've thought this out. I know Alan loves me, I know how he loves me, and I believe I can help him, oh, not in the ways I had fancied before, but just merely by loving him." She paused, but Mrs. Quentin made no sign. I see it all so differently now. I see what an influence love itself may be, how my believing in him, loving him, accepting him just as he is, might help him more than any theories, any arguments. I might have seen this long ago in looking at you, as he often told me, in seeing how you'd kept yourself apart from Mr. Quentin's work, and has been always the beautiful side of life to them, kept their faith alive in spite of themselves, not by interfering, preaching, reforming, but by just loving them, and being there. She looked at Mrs. Quentin with a simple nobleness. It isn't as if I cared for the money, you know. If I cared for that, I should be afraid. You will care for it in time, Mrs. Quentin said suddenly. Miss Fenno drew back, releasing her hand. In time? Yes, when there's nothing else left. She stared a moment at the pictures. My poor child, she broke out, I've heard all you say so often before. You've heard it? Yes, from myself. I felt as you do, I argued as you do, I acted as I mean to prevent your doing, when I married Alan's father. The long empty gallery seemed to reverberate with the girl's startled exclamation, Mrs. Quentin, hush, let me speak. Do you suppose I'd do this if you were the kind of pink and white idiot you ought to have married? It's because I see you're alive, as I was, tingling with beliefs, ambitions, energies, as I was, that I can't see you walled up alive, as I was, without stretching out a hand to save you. She sat gazing rigidly forward, her eyes on the pictures, speaking in the low, precipitate tone of one who tries to press the meaning of a lifetime into a few breathless sentences. When I met Alan's father, she went on, I knew nothing of his work. We met abroad, where I had been living with my mother. That was 26 years ago, when the Radiator was less notorious than it is now. I knew my husband owned a newspaper, a great newspaper, and nothing more. I had never seen a copy of the Radiator. I had no notion what it stood for, in politics or in other ways. We were married in Europe, and a few months afterward we came to live here. People were already beginning to talk about the Radiator. My husband, on leaving college, had bought it with some money an old uncle had left him, and the public at first was merely curious to see what an ambitious, stirring young man without any experience of journalism was going to make out of his experiment. They found first of all that he was going to make a great deal of money out of it. I found that out too. I was so happy in other ways that it didn't make much difference at first, though it was pleasant to be able to help my mother, to be generous and charitable, to live in a nice house, and wear the handsome gowns he liked to see me in. But still it didn't really count. It counted so little that when, one day, I learned what the Radiator was, I would have gone out into the streets barefooted, rather than live another hour on the money it brought in. Her voice sank, and she paused to steady it. The girl at her side did not speak or move. I shall never forget that day, she began again. The paper had stripped bare some family scandal, some miserable bleeding secret that a dozen unhappy people had been struggling to keep out of print, that would have been kept out if my husband had not. Oh, you must guess the rest. I can't go on. She felt a hand on hers. Why, you mustn't go on, Mrs. Quentin, the girl whispered. Yes, I must. You must be made to understand. She drew a deep breath. My husband, and was not like Alan. When he found out how I felt about it, he was surprised at first, but gradually he began to see, or at least I fancied he saw, the hatefulness of it. At any rate, he saw how I suffered, and he offered to give up the whole thing to sell the paper. It couldn't be done all of a sudden. Of course he made me see that, for he had put all his money in it, and he had no special aptitude for any other kind of work. He was a born journalist like Alan. It was a great sacrifice for him to give up the paper, but he promised to do it in time, when a good opportunity offered. Meanwhile, of course, he wanted to build it up, to increase the circulation, and to do that he had to keep on in the same way he made that clear to me. I saw that we were in a vicious circle. The paper, to sell well, had to be made more and more detestable and disgraceful. At first I rebelled, but somehow I can't tell you how it was after that first concession the ground seemed to give under me. With every struggle I sank deeper. And then Alan was born. He was such a delicate baby that there was very little hope of saving him. But money did it, the money from the paper. I took him abroad to see the best physicians. I took him to a warm climate every winter. In hot weather the doctors recommended sea air, and we had a yacht and cruised every summer. I owed his life to the Radiator. And when he began to grow stronger the habit was formed, the habit of luxury. He could not get on without the things he had always been used to. He pined in bad air. He drooped under monotony and discomfort. He throve on variety, amusement, travel, every kind of novelty and excitement. And all I wanted for him his inexhaustible foster mother was there to give. My husband said nothing, but he must have seen how things were going. There was no more talk of giving up the Radiator. He never reproached me with my inconsistency, but I thought he must despise me, and the thought made me reckless. I determined to ignore the paper altogether, to take what it gave, as though I didn't know where it came from. And to excuse this, I invented the theory that one may, so to speak, purify money by putting it to good uses. I gave away a great deal in charity. I indulged myself very little at first. All the money that was not spent on Alan I tried to do good with. But gradually, as my boy grew up, the problem became more complicated. How was I to protect Alan from the contamination I had let him live in? I couldn't preach by example, couldn't hold up his father as a warning, or denounce the money we were living on. All I could do was to disguise the inner ugliness of life by making it beautiful outside, to build a wall of beauty between him and the facts of life, turn his tastes and interests another way, hide the radiator from him as a smiling woman at a ball may hide a cancer in her breast. Just as Alan was entering college, his father died. Then I saw my way clear. I had loved my husband, and yet I drew my first free breath in years. For the radiator had been left to Alan outright. There was nothing on earth to prevent his selling it when he came of age. And there was no excuse for his not selling it. I had brought him up to depend on money, but the paper had given us enough money to gratify all his tastes. At last we could turn on the monster that had nourished us. I felt a savage joy in the thought. I could hardly bear to wait till Alan came of age. But I had never spoken to him of the paper, and I didn't dare speak of it now. Some false shame kept me back, some vague belief in his ignorance. I would wait till he was 21, and then we should be free. I waited, the day came, and I spoke. You can guess his answer, I suppose. He had no idea of selling the radiator. It wasn't the money he cared for, it was the career that tempted him. He was a born journalist, and his ambition, ever since he could remember, had been to carry on his father's work, to develop, to surpass it. There was nothing in the world as interesting as modern journalism. He couldn't imagine any other kind of life that wouldn't bore him to death. A newspaper like the Radiator might be made one of the biggest powers on earth, and he loved power and meant to have all he could get. I listened to him in a kind of trance. I couldn't find a word to say. His father had had scruples, he had none. I seemed to realize at once that argument would be useless. I don't know that I even tried to plead with him, he was so bright and hard and inaccessible. Then I saw that he was, after all, what I had made him, the creature of my concessions, my connivances, my evasions. That was the price I had paid for him. I had kept him at that cost. Well, I had kept him, at any rate. That was the feeling that survived. He was my boy, my son, my very own, till some other woman took him. Meanwhile, the old life must go on as it could. I gave up the struggle. If at that point he was inaccessible, at others he was close to me. He has always been a perfect son. Our tastes grew together. We enjoyed the same books, the same pictures, the same people. All I had to do was to look at him in profile to see the side of him that was really mine. At first I kept thinking of the dreadful other side, but gradually the impression faded, and I kept my mind turned from it, as one does from a deformity in a face one loves. I thought I had made my last compromise with life, had hit on the modus vivendi that would last my time. And then he met you. I had always been prepared for his marrying, but not a girl like you. I thought he would choose a sweet thing who would never pry into his closets. He hated women with ideas. But as soon as I saw you, I knew the struggle would have to begin again. He is so much stronger than his father. He is full of the most monstrous convictions. And he has the courage of them. Who you saw last year, that his love for you never made him waver. He believes in his work. He adores it. It is a kind of hideous idol to which he would make human sacrifices. He loves you still. I've been honest with you, but his love wouldn't change him. It is you who would have to change to die gradually, as I have died, till there is only one live point left in me. Ah, if one died completely, that's simple enough. But something persists, remember, that a single point, an aching nerve of truth. Now and then you may drug it, but a touch wakes it again, as your face has waked it in me. There's always enough of one's old self left to suffer with. Dot dot. She stood up, and faced the girl abruptly. What shall I tell Alan? She said. Miss Fenno sat motionless, her eyes on the ground. Twilight was falling on the gallery, a twilight which seemed to emanate, not so much from the glass dome overhead, as from the crepuscular depths into which the faces of the pictures were receding. The custodian's step sounded warningly down the corridor. When the girl looked up, she was alone. A Venetian night's entertainment, This is the story that, in the dining room of the old Beacon Street house, now the Aldebaran Club, Judge Anthony Bracknell, of the famous East India firm of Bracknell and Soulsby, when the ladies had withdrawn to the oval parlor and Maria's harp was throwing its gauzy web of sound across the common, used to relate to his grandsons, about the year that Buonaparte marched upon Moscow. In Venice, said the Lascar with the big earrings, and Tony Bracknell, leaning on the high gunwale of his father's East Indiaman, the Hepzibah, saw far off, across the morning sea, a faint vision of towers and domes dissolved in golden air. It was a rare February day of the year 1760, and a young Tony, newly of age, and bound on the grand tour aboard the crack merchantman of old Bracknell's fleet, felt his heart leap up as the distant city trembled into shape. Venice. The name, since childhood, had been a magician's wand to him. In the hall of the old Bracknell house at Salem there hung a series of yellowing prints which Uncle Richard Soulsby had brought home from one of his long voyages. Views of heathen mosques and palaces, of the Grand Turk's Seraglio, of St. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.